This is the 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
This is Elizabeth Anderson. It's the second Saturday. It is the Santa Moran Radio Book Club. Today we have well-known author Lynn Ames, who's going to talk about her two most recent books, Chain Reactions and Secrets Well Kept. We're going to talk with Tara Scott, who is a reviewer and an avid reader. Tara, are you on the line?
I am. Hello.
And Lynn Ames, who is in Provincetown right now. Lynn, are you there?
I'm actually in Lee, New Hampshire right now.
You are, but you're going to be heading to Provincetown, right?
I am en route to Provincetown for Women's Week, which is always a lot of fun, one of my favorite events of the year, to talk about books, oddly enough.
Oddly enough. And you'll be doing readings, and I assume you might be on a panel?
I'm doing some readings, a few panel discussions, and some book signings, and all kinds of fun things.
I went to Women's Week 2 years ago and was amazed to see this iconic Cape Cod town just turned over to women of all kinds on the streets, music, film, and most especially literature. Tara, have you ever been?
No, not yet. I'd love to go, though.
Tara, let's talk a little bit about your reviewing. Would you tell who you review for?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a regular reviewer at The Lesbian Review, which exclusively reviews books about queer women. Also at Lambda Literary and Smart Bitches Trashy Books, which is a mainstream romance blog, but they've recently expanded their reviewers to be more inclusive, and there's a few of us that are representing the FF reading audience.
Lynn, would you tell a little about your history as an author, the books you've published, and these two most recent books that we're going to talk about?
Well, sure. I think the last book I wrote, Secrets Well Kept, was my 15th book. It means I'm at least 20 years old, mostly. But I write all kinds of things. I write what's in my heart, and I hope because it's in my heart, it will be in the reader's hearts as well. I write historical fiction. I write romances, contemporary and historical. I write thrillers and action-adventure romances and romantic comedies. There you go. An eclectic mix.
Definitely. We were just talking about Provincetown, and I was interested in the fact that Chain Reactions is in large part set in Provincetown, and it was very clear from your description of the Massachusetts scenery and some of the restaurants that you had been there.
Twice, or perhaps for 30 years or more.
I laughed when I read about them meeting at the Lobster Pot and the eight young lesbians loudly discussing the merits of various gender-neutral pronouns, a sliding scale of gender identity, and their own preferences. So you're obviously au courant.
Well, I try to be au courant.
Tara, talk to me about Chain Reactions and what your reaction was when you had finished it.
It's an interesting book. It's mostly set now, but there's a strong kind of backstory to it of what happens with Nora. And thankfully, Lynn delivered that story so that we could follow up, because that was what I wanted to know, was what was Nora's past. And the thing that really stood out for me about this book was that idea of family. You know, because it has, Diana thinks she knew what happened with her family. Her aunt disappeared. Her aunt wasn't interested in her. But at the same time, her aunt had been there all along and had loved her all along and followed from afar, but as close as she could without blowing up the family. And at the same time, she kind of makes a new family as she finds love. And I thought there was just something really beautiful about rediscovering family that's been lost, forging new family, and then being able to read Secrets Well Kept and seeing, you know, what love looked like for Nora at different points as well was really powerful.
I thought the family dynamics were realistic. When I came out in my early 40s, my entire family did not react well. And so Diana losing her grandfather and her parents, it made sense to me. Lynn, what made you come up with that kind of family background?
Well, you know, I think that's, as you just alluded to, it's not a unique experience for, unfortunately, too many LGBTQIA people, that is a prevalent reaction, and it was a particularly prevalent reaction back in the 70s and 80s when I was coming out and when a lot of my contemporaries were coming out. And so I really wanted to hearken back to what it was like back then and to contrast it a little bit with where we are now. I hope we're making progress. It was such an important family dynamic at the time, in that time frame, and I wanted to frame it that way because I think there are a lot of folks who are a generation behind me and two generations behind me and now three generations behind me who don't really know what that history was and what it was like to take a risk back then, as Nora did by attending an event which eventually led to her brother discovering about her and their reaction. And then the next generation, you know, they were still having trouble with Diana, so they hadn't learned the lessons of history. And so I wanted to play a little bit with that idea of learning the lessons of history, and you would have hoped to have seen the progress, and yet it wasn't quite there. So Diana ended up suffering the way Nora ended up suffering in some way. And, you know, this is, I think, very realistic and very true for too many families. I think we call attention to it and we allow people to recognize and see themselves in these books. And as well as seeing themselves, they also see that it can have a different ending. It can have a happier ending.
You mentioned in a post that yesterday was coming out day, and I think what a lot of straight people don't realize, and Tara, I'll throw this to you as well, is you come out constantly as an LGBTQ person. You have to decide, you know, in a hair salon, in travel, an ordinary business transaction, it's like, well, do I tell them or not? At a family gathering, Tara, do you find that is true?
Oh, absolutely. I was actually really kind of heartened to see that at work. So we had Pride I'm in Calgary, Canada, and our Pride was in September. And I work at a company that is highly dedicated to ensuring that it's inclusive for everyone. And so they announced during Pride that they were putting up signs on the bathrooms to say that you can use the bathroom that matters for you, and that they are committed to actually building gender-neutral bathrooms, because we do have some non-binary people that work there. And to thank the CEO and the person who runs, like, our VP of HR, to properly thank them, I had to out myself, because otherwise it's just, I think this is a cool thing. And so I find myself outing myself to people I don't even realize I'm going to, because they need to understand that what they're doing matters for people.
It does. Lynn, you alluded to this important meeting. It was an LGBT meeting, I believe the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and I think it was
1977, and
yes.
It was a real meeting. It really happened.
I believe it was arranged by Midge Costanza, who was in the Carter administration.
Midge Costanza.
You knew her, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah, force of nature. That woman was a force of nature.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how brave someone would have had to have been to attend that meeting?
What we're talking about happens in chain reactions. It's sort of a flashback to something that happened in the 70s, and it was a difficult time, and this was the very first time that a formal invitation had been issued to lesbian and gay folks to come to the White House and sit down in an official capacity with someone from the White House to talk about their issues. This is a real meeting that happened in the White House. Midge Costanza worked for the Carter administration, and she brought them in and sat them down around the table. It was mostly men, with maybe one or two women in the room, to hear their concerns and to see if there was any common ground. And Midge Costanza really did initiate this meeting. And I really like to bring true facts into my fiction, because I think oftentimes this is the only way people understand and learn our history. They're not going to read a history book, but they might read my novel and actually find something else out. But the meeting really did happen. It was groundbreaking at the time. And those who were in the room were weeping for the fact that they had a seat at the table, literally a seat at the table for the first time. Now, Carter never came in the room, but it was a meeting of an official White House person talking to this group. And by the way, Midge herself was a lesbian.
We find out more about Nora in Secrets Well Kept. We learn her history, and it makes sense that she would have attended that meeting. And it also makes sense that a photographer would have been there. And unfortunately, there are people who leak for good reasons, and there are people who leak for bad reasons. Let's talk a little about characters. Tara, in Chain Reactions, who were some of the most memorable characters for you?
Well, Nora was just a firecracker. I absolutely loved her. She was hands down my favorite character. I mean, I liked everybody, but she was my favorite for sure.
I agree with you. One of the things I really admired in the description of Nora at age 100, my parents are 95 and 93. And I see them fairly often. They live in Canada, in Victoria. Lynn, you described what it's like to be, and I'm not being pejorative here. I think most would agree that 100 is elderly. But her extreme frailness, her thinking back to the past and having nightmares about an incident that was pivotal in her life, her shortness of breath, but her mind is alert. You did very well at capturing someone at age 100. Would you talk a little about that?
Well, thank you, first of all. I'm glad that it rang true. And, you know, those of us who have dealt with aging parents or aging parents-in-law or aging family members of choice, you know this story only too well. And, you know, watch as aging takes the people we were. And so to write Nora, realistically, I've watched too many, unfortunately, age that way. And so I took a little bit of people I knew. I took a little bit of my wife Cheryl's mom and her dad, who recently passed. And I took a little bit of my dear friend Dot Wilkinson, who just turned 98. And I added in, you know, some other elements of other people I know. And I thought, okay, so what would it be like if I was in their shoes? How would it feel to be trapped in a frail, failing body while my mind is still perfectly sharp and I'm able to understand all that's happening around me, and I know where this is going? Am I resigned to it? Am I going to treat it with humor and grace, or am I going to go fighting? How am I going to deal with this, and what legacy am I going to leave behind? And I think for Nora, as she's going through this process in her mind, she doesn't mind dying. And, you know, Dot is very good about this. Dot constantly says to me, and I talk to her every day, "So I'm ready to go. All my friends are in heaven. It doesn't matter. I'm ready. I've lived a great, full life. I've seen everything. I've done everything. I have no regrets. I just want to make sure that I have everything in order and that the people I'm leaving behind are set, that they're in good shape, that they're in, you know, a place where I want them to be, happy and healthy and their lives fulfilled." And so I approached Nora from that perspective, as well as the perspective of, I've got this thing in my past. Have I reconciled it? Have I done what I needed to do? Is there anything I've left unfinished? Is there anything that I can do to change or to ameliorate the situation going forward? And so that was sort of my mindset when I created Nora. I love Nora, too. She's probably my favorite character as well, especially at 100. I loved her at 25 in Secrets Well Kept, but I especially loved her at 100. You know, she's spunky. My grandmother was very spunky, my mom. And so she reminds me, personality-wise, a lot of my grandmother.
I think Tara described her well. I think she referred to her as a firecracker. Tara, yeah. How did you feel about Nora's meddling? Because she clearly was. She would say to Brenda, "So, do you have anyone in your life? Any husbands, boyfriends? What's the deal?" And then she would go to Diana, her great niece, and say, "Guess what?" How did you feel about her meddling? Was that okay? Was it okay strictly because she was 100? What's the deal?
I don't know if it was okay or not, but I kind of think there is something to the idea that somebody who's 100 is going to do what they're going to do, and there's not a lot that's going to stop them. So I didn't mind it. I thought it was very cute. None of it came across as controlling, which I think made a big difference. It was all came from a very good place. And I think if Brooke and Diana didn't have any chemistry and they weren't interested, that would have been fine too. Like, I don't think she would have kept pushing if that wasn't there, but it was there. So I think she was just giving them that little nudge that they might not have been able to give themselves otherwise.
good point, too, about it would have been okay even if they weren't attracted to each other. She would have dropped it. I hadn't even thought about that. Tara, what about the male characters? Dr. Dan Goodwin and Charles Fitzgerald, the attorney. A lot of lesbian novels really don't have sympathetic male characters or don't even have male characters. You're a reviewer. You've probably seen this. What did you think of the male characters, particularly in Chain Reactions?
I liked them. I liked Dan the Doctor. I mean, the thing that was nice was that they weren't there a lot, which is fine. It's not their story, but they were, like, fully fleshed out characters. These were men that you could imagine, and that they were good guys. Like, it is nice to come across men who are good guys in lesbian fiction because it does feel rare sometimes. So whether it is a father or a brother, or in the case of these men in this book, like, they're found family too. Like, they are part of Nora's family, who were able to be a part of her life when her family of blood let her down. Like, I think at one point, was it Mary? I think it was Mary in Chain Reactions who refers to her brother Bill as a horse's ass, and he totally was.
Yes.
So it was nice that there were these other men that she could forge really good, healthy, positive relationships with.
Yes, her brother is a bad actor in both books. Lynn, you want to talk a little bit about male characters?
Sure, I would love to. And thank you for the opportunity to do so. You know, to me, I always try to make my fiction as realistic as possible. And the truth is, we have a lot of men in our lives, and some of them are really great guys. And some are not. It's true for everybody. And, you know, if you're going to write fiction that is realistic and that hews to what our lives are truly like, then I think you have to present a rounded picture of every character who exists. You can't completely vilify and you can't completely exonerate. I think we are all flawed human beings. And so I really try to remember that as I'm creating these fictional, I hope very realistic characters. And in this case, I mean, I knew that Nora's brother Bill was going to be a jerk. He's just a jerk. There's no two ways about it. And you know, many of us have encountered a character like Bill, a guy who, you know, feels very entitled and thinks that we call it white privilege now. And he is just, he's a bad guy. And I consciously said, I know I have to have the tension of that guy in this book, but I really want to offset it with the realism of other good men who are, you know, just the opposite, who are kind and compassionate and family of choice to Nora. And, I mean, you can see both these guys really respect Nora. They are in awe of her in some ways, and that you can feel, I hope, the palpable affection that they all have for each other. And I think that's important because it's well-rounded, it's real, and it's a good object lesson in humanity. And I always like to put object lessons of humanity in there somewhere.
Well, and you do it deftly.
Thank you.
I forget his name, but Diana's boss there at Columbia, her department head, when she says, you know what, I think I'll just apply to Harvard. He's very supportive. He's shocked initially, but he is supportive. I was in academia, and it made sense to me that she would be able to make that transition to another institution. I think you probably, Lynn, checked that out, right, with some people in academia.
I did.
Because
I checked with probably a half dozen folks in academia, both on the professor side and on the administration side, because I wanted to be certain that what she wanted to do was possible, first of all, and second of all, that it was plausible in the way that it happened. I took what everybody said to me, all of the answers I got back, and I sort of synthesized them and thought I took a little bit of this and a little bit of that and melded them together to make a scenario that I hope rings true to those who have been in academia and also serves the purpose of advancing the plot. If it doesn't advance the plot, don't put it in there. And so I really tried hard to get those facts right because it's not my world. And so, you know, anytime I write something that's not necessarily my world, I'm going to do triple the amount of research just to make sure I get it right.
If you have a prestigious grant, such as this one, an NIH grant, then you have leverage. And that's
right.
That, I thought, is what you depicted very accurately.
Thank you. I'm sure glad you thought so. You know, every now and again, serendipity helps. And it turns out that one of our neighbors has a lab named after him at MD Anderson in Houston. And he turned out to be very, very helpful in this regard in helping me understand the NIH system, the grant system, and how such a thing might have worked. So it's great when perfect research falls into your lap.
It is. And of course, I don't want to give anything too important away, but it was critical that that happened. We're talking with author Lynn Ames about her most recent novels, Chain Reactions and Secrets Well Kept. The panelist is Tara Scott, a well-known reviewer. And I would like to turn now to Secrets Well Kept. And I loved this book. Historical fiction is one of my very favorite genres. There was so much in this book that just kept me absolutely captivated from page one.
Well, that's high praise. Thank you.
Tara, do you want to give a little bit of your impressions about Secrets Well Kept?
Absolutely. I just finished reading it a couple of nights ago, and I loved it too. I actually typically don't pick up World War II fiction, and I don't know why that is, because I've had consistently pretty good experience. I had a really good time with Marianne K. Martin's The Liberators of Willow Run as well. It's just not something I usually reach for, but this book was so good. It was very hard to put down. One of the things I really appreciated about it was that it clearly tremendous research had gone into it, but I never felt like anybody was hitting me over the head with a whole bunch of information. Like, it just was naturally infused into everything to present that realistic, like, bring us in as if we're watching a movie. By the way, this should be a movie, but there was never any info dumping, which can be a problem with research books sometimes. It was so good. The characters were so vivid. Everything about it worked for me.
I saw that this was a prequel, and I thought about reading it first, and then I thought, no, I'll read Chain Reactions first and then go back and look at Nora's background. I'm so glad I did that, because I had an idea who Nora was, and then I found out so much more. Lynn, what made you decide to write the two books together? Did you know when you were writing Chain Reactions that Secrets Well Kept was right behind?
Well, first of all, I think I should just retire now. Yes, I did know that. The way these books came about was my wife, Cheryl, put a book on the table in front of me, a nonfiction book, because she's a nonfiction kind of girl. And the book was called The Girls of the Atomic City by Denise Kiernan. And there was a post-it on the front of the book that said, I think there might be a story in here. And, of course, I went down the rabbit hole and read this book, and I thought, oh, my God, is there a story in here? It's a story of these women in World War II who created the fuel for the atomic bomb but didn't really know what they were doing. And I thought, well, oh, my God, yeah, well, how would that feel for me if I had been told I was doing something for the war effort? And then on August 9th, or August 6th, in this case for Hiroshima, 1945, I woke up and discovered that what I'd actually been doing has been creating fuel for the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima, a bomb that, yes, ended the war and allowed us to bring all of our soldiers home, but on the other hand, I killed hundreds of thousands of people. How would that feel to me ethically and morally? What a dilemma that would be. You know, Oak Ridge, Tennessee was a secret city in World War II. In the 1940s, Oak Ridge, Tennessee was not on any map. And so everything that happened there, there were 75,000 people living in a city that wasn't on the map, doing something that nobody knew exactly what they were doing. Even the people who were doing it, with a few notable exceptions, did not know what they were creating. And I thought, well, that's just a fascinating premise. So I went to Oak Ridge, we went to Oak Ridge, and toured the place, what you can tour anyway, because the building itself, the Y-12 building that I spent so much time in Secrets Well Kept, is closed to the public. You can't get in there. So everything I described was given to me by both an actual cubicle operator who I was able to interview, one of these women who did this job. I was able to interview her. She was very sharp and wonderful at 93, Ruth Huddleston. And then the Oak Ridge historian, and so on and so forth. The amount of research that went into this book was just ridiculous, I have to say, because there weren't many records, because it was, I don't know, a secret city. But there was a photographer, Ed Westcott, who was able to capture everything that went on. He had full access, and he captured everything that went on. And thank God for him, and for the recollections of those who worked there. But when I went to Oak Ridge, I stood literally in the middle of the American Museum of Science and Energy, and I stopped and I turned around to my wife and I said, this isn't one book, it's two books. There's a story of Nora in Chain Reactions looking back on her life and this dilemma and how she felt about it and how she dealt with it throughout her life and what she did with what had happened. And then there's the story of Nora in the middle of it and living it in real time. I said, it's not one story, it's two stories. And I think that I need to write Chain Reactions first, the modern day story, so that there's this sense of mystery around Nora and you want to know more about her. And honestly, in a purely business manner, I would have to say, you know, from that perspective, contemporary romance sells better than historical fiction. It's just a fact. And so I insidiously decided that I would write the contemporary book first, draw people in, hook them into Nora so that they had to know more about her, and then I would write Secrets Well Kept, which would give them the rest of Nora's story, present day and from 1943 to 1945. I did know that it was going to be two books. I did know that one would follow the other. I did know that I needed to write them in quick succession so that there wasn't too long a lag from the time you read Chain Reactions to the time you read Secrets Well Kept. Now, I did write them so you could read them in either order. So it's interesting to me that you were glad that you read Chain Reactions first. I've heard feedback going both ways. People who read Secrets Well Kept first and then read Chain Reactions afterwards and were glad they'd done it in that order. People who read Chain Reactions and then thought, you know, I don't know what I would think about Nora present day. And, you know, my answer to that is always, just give it a shot, will you? Just give it a shot.
So I read Chain Reactions first because I reviewed it for Lando, where it was clear that, you know, I liked it. And I was a little nervous going in to read Secrets Well Kept, and I'm glad that I read it in the order that I did because I've talked about this a few times on my own podcast, but there is a problem in the lesbian reading community of expecting that if there is a book with lesbians, and especially if there's a relationship, that it must always be a romance. It doesn't matter if it's a thriller. It doesn't matter. Like, it literally doesn't matter what genre it is. People are going to think it's a romance no matter what. And Secrets Well Kept has a romance. It has a very strong romantic theme, but it's a historical. Knowing the way romance readers are, if they read Secrets Well Kept first, they might not be happy when they get to Chain Reactions. If they read Chain Reactions first, I think they're going to find Secrets Well Kept is real. It's a really beautiful, rich story, and there's a lot to be satisfied with both.
You make such an excellent point. Let's go to the relationship. The two protagonists in Secrets Well Kept, the prequel, are Mary Trask and Nora Lindstrom. I want to ask you first, Tara, and then we'll turn to Lynn. Was it realistic for you that Nora and Mary basically fell into each other's arms and were intimate on a first date, given the circumstances?
I honestly don't know if I can answer that because I grew up in such a wildly different context, but I would say it didn't ring untrue. I had no issues with it when I was reading it.
For me, it rang so true. And the reasons, and Lynn, I'll ask you to address this, were the circumstances. They're in this, I didn't know there were 75,000 people, but I knew it was a huge enterprise, basically an entire city that had sprung up from nothing. They're lonely. They're cut off from everybody except the people they're working with. They can't say anything, and they're scared because there are spies among them. So to say anything at all about what they're doing is risky, and it's extremely high pressure. Well, we see what happens when Mary lets the needle go too far one time. Their job is always at risk. And so to me, you have these two women who know they're not attracted to men, and they've never experienced real love, and there are sparks immediately, but they're in this situation. That's what made it ring true for me. Lynn, was that what you were intending?
Well, here's the thing. I hope it rang true, and I hope that it was realistic, because remember that there's a backstory here, and that neither one of these women, girls really at that age, were coming to this without any context for themselves. Mary had been getting pressure and pressure and pressure to marry this high school boyfriend that she had that her mother was so insistent that she do. And I mean, Mary just knew something wasn't right about it, but she didn't know exactly what it was. Nora, on the other hand, had always thrown herself into her work. She kind of had a sense of who she was, but she wasn't, she'd never done anything about it. And I think that in that day and age, when there was so much pressure to conform, so much pressure to do as society intended for you to do, that when you finally get to the point where you see that one person that just sets off all of those feelings inside you, hormonal and otherwise, it's like an explosion and a release of what's possible. And finally, that moment where it clicks and you truly figure out who you are, whether you think it's right or it's wrong, and I mean, there's all that warring inside you of, oh my God, am I doing something that's really wrong, or am I breaking the law? I'm doing something that, you know, is against what I should be doing. Am I a freak? And yet here's this one other person who feels the way you do, and you figure there's nobody else in the world like you. I think that all of that kind of pressure and all of those kinds of feelings result in the scene that happened between them. It's just such a myriad of emotion and such a really strong emotion that it's almost impossible not to release that at that moment.
I agree. And Mary had an additional issue that made her feel like a bit of a freak in that she had undiagnosed dyslexia and she couldn't do well taking written tests. She had a kind teacher who gave her orals. She was very afraid when she did meet this special someone that this would be a real problem. Also, that she might not be hired because to take a written test would be very difficult. What you had said, Lynn, early on in our discussion of this book, Velvet Lounger, who's a reviewer in the Lesbian Reading Room, says, "But for me personally, the real impact is that of a bunch of high school graduate level women with no scientific training being the instruments, and they were literally the tools of the war machine that was determined to win the nuclear race and use that victory to end the war." And Mary was one of the top Calutron operators because she could concentrate and she did focus and it didn't require reading. I thought that the dyslexia rang true, and that was really a good thing to have brought forward. Tara?
I agree. I thought it was really interesting because there were all these men who were, they either had PhDs or were PhD candidates, it seemed like, because they were trying to solve the problem. They were trying to solve as they were doing the work, and it was getting in the way of actually doing the work. So bringing people in, showing them, this is your task. Just do your task allowed for a much more focused approach that clearly worked.
That was actually very true. In all of the interviews that I did and all of the reading that I did and the research that I did, it is absolutely true that Ernest Lawrence, who was, of course, the famous physicist who created the Calutron, and his PhD students in the lab at UCal Berkeley were working on the Calutron machine. And they were the only ones to that point who had ever operated the machine. As Tara said, they were overthinking it. They kept trying to make corrections. You know, they were using their brains instead of using their instincts. These high school girls, all of whom were hired, 22 plus thousand of them, to run these Calutron machines, they were simply trained to sit there, watch these needles, turn this knob if it does this, do this if it does that. They couldn't overthink it because they didn't know what they were thinking about. And the fact is that Ernest Lawrence really did make a bet about who could do the job better, his PhD students or these high school graduate girls. And the truth was that the high school girls did do it better. They got better results out of the machines. They produced more pure products, more uranium-235 and 238. They were just better at it. And he couldn't believe it. He was astounded by that. But it was very true. That's exactly what happened. And, you know, there was nobody like Nora. I will say that. There was no Nora in that scenario. There was not a woman who oversaw the Calutron girls. But I really felt like, well, wouldn't that have been the obvious thing? You know, and wouldn't that have been just like these guys to think, oh, well, we'll just put a woman in charge because she can relate to these women, these girls. And if she can't do the job well, it's just because she's a woman, and we'll just throw her out of there and bring in a man to, you know, obviously do the job right.
I was somewhat amused that Nora, when she first finds out what she's going to be doing, she learns that they're actually working on two alloy. And I thought, oh, that can't be an actual term. And looked it up, and it was what the young women were told they were doing was making tuballoy, and it was enriched uranium. Did you already know that, Lynn, or was that something you discovered?
Yeah. No, well, first of all, I was an American history major in college. But I did not learn about the women at Oak Ridge in college. I never learned about them. But they had a code word for everything. The bomb was a big boy and fat man, you know, and little man. They used terminology that was created by General Leslie Groves and Robert Oppenheimer, a name we all know from as the father of the atomic bomb, so that no one would know what they were doing. And in fact, when they named one of the three facilities at Oak Ridge, they were named K-25 and Y-12 and X-10 for the graphite reactor. And when they realized that they had named it Y-12, somebody went ballistic about it because, of course, if you look at your periodic table, you find out that it related to uranium. And so, like, that was too obvious. That was too obvious. But they had code names for everything. It was called Tuvalu, and they used everything that meant something else because this was such a secret operation, and they were so concerned that the Germans were going to beat them to the punch and develop the bomb first. And there were early indications that that was going to happen, and fortunately it didn't. We got very lucky there, but they didn't know for a long time whether or not it was going to happen. And you have to realize they spent all these years, 3 years essentially, and all this money to get what was essentially a product the size of a football. That's what they created. All that work, all those hours, 3 years' time, working around the clock, they created enough enriched uranium for a football-size bomb.
That's remarkable. I did like Nora, even though she's fictional, being in charge of the women, because I think we've seen recently, both in literature and in film, that women were busy creating, supervising, conceiving, researching, and didn't always get credit. For instance, the movie Hidden Figures, to think that women were so crucial to NASA. Another, it's fiction, but Lucy Jane Bledsoe, the fictional character Lucy Bell, is based on her aunt, a scientist, and the great artist, Edith Lake Wilkinson, there in Provincetown, changed art, and she was locked away in an asylum, and the documentary is packed in a trunk. And Tara, you already mentioned Marianne K. Martin's Liberators of Willow Run. How do you feel when you read or see women who have really had their stories ignored?
It's heartening to see the stories coming forward. And even actually in fictional stories, getting to see women be heroes. I have two young daughters. They're 4, and the oldest one is turning 8 next week. And I actually cried when I saw Wonder Woman and when I saw Rey in Star Wars. Because these were not the kinds of characters that I got to grow up with in the 80s. And so, again, as a mother, getting to see films like Hidden Figures and saying, you know what, I cannot wait to show that to my daughters when they're a little bit older. To see books with great stories of great women, like the Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girl. Like, these stories are so crucial for other women to see. We can do great things. We can do amazing things, even if other people tell us that we can't. It's totally possible.
It really is. I want to ask you this, Lynn. Speaking of stories that are important, do you want to tell a little bit about your next project?
Sure, I can. But before I do, I should say, I mean, that's the reason why I write historical fiction, is to deal with this issue of erasure that has been persistent throughout our humanity. And to write ourselves back into history, where we were all along and where we belong, whether these are fictional characters or not, they're living in very real worlds. That is so important. And it's important. I realize most people won't sit down and read a textbook, but they might read one of my books, Eyes on the Stars, or Bright Lights of Summer, or Chain Reactions, or Secrets Well Kept. And that's the kind of role modeling we need to do. We need to write ourselves back in because nobody else is going to do it for us. And in that vein, what I'm working on now is nonfiction. It is the biography of I mentioned Dot Wilkinson earlier. She is my very dear friend. She just turned 98. She's the greatest catcher who ever played the game of women's softball. She has a rich and historic and amazing life, and I am very grateful that she has chosen me to write her official biography. And that is what I am working on right this second. I'm working on Dot's biography. She played for the PBSW Phoenix Ramblers from 1933 to 1965. It's just a remarkable life, not just for the things that she was able to accomplish in softball, and she was also a member of the National Bowling Hall of Fame. But this woman and her partner, her female partner, were flipping houses in the 1960s, in a time when nobody knew what flipping houses was. And they had, at one time, more than 50 houses in play in Phoenix, Arizona, at the same time, made $1 million doing this, just the two of them, doing all the work themselves. It's just a remarkable life, and I feel very blessed to be able to tell this story. Deep into it right now, and I hope to get it done sometime in the next few months. It'll be great.
I look forward to reading it. And Lynn, how could someone find out more about you? You have a website.
I have a website, www.lynnames.com, L-Y-N-N, Nancy Nancy, A-M as in Mary, E-S, lynnames.com. You can absolutely find me there. Find me on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, and come see me in Provincetown or at Clexicon in April, at the Golden Crown Literary Society Conference in July, in Albuquerque in 2020. I am ubiquitous. I'm everywhere, don't you know? And by the way, donate to KKFI. It's a fabulous station. This is a fabulous show. Elizabeth does an incredible job with it. I am still ogling the KKFI sweatshirt zip-up that Cheryl has that I just want. I want it. And she won't give it to me. I don't know why.
Well, I happen to be wearing a Legacies of Lesbian Literature Project sweatshirt with a quote from Joel Gomez. So, let me just quickly ask you, Tara, is there a way to find you? I know you're on Facebook.
Actually, the best way to find me is on Twitter, Tara M. D. Scott, so M as in Mary, D as in David in the middle there, and I actually tweet out 5 reviews a day that I've done previously. I've heard a lot of people say they don't know how to find good lesbian fiction. Follow me, you will get it every single day.
And that's very true. So any last thoughts before we go? We have about a minute.
Well, I just want to say thank you to you, Elizabeth, for doing this show, for doing it. Sandra was, you know, one of my best friends, as you know, and a wonderful human being. And I know that she's just looking down, proud as she can be, for the show and all of the amazing guests that you've had on and the work that you're doing. That is just so important. And, I mean, what I'd say to your audience is read. Keep reading. Keep reading our stories. Keep celebrating our history and our present. And I promise that it does get better, and it's going to get better. Today marks, of course, the 21st anniversary of Matthew Shepard's death. And, you know, the fight's not over, folks.